Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's just like taking candy from a baby, 'cause I couldn't resist you from the very start. You had me around your little finger. No trouble at all for you to tiptoe in my heart.
Another side of Fred Astaire. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, the case for the famous song and dance man as an influential musician and advocate for swing. Plus, details about a new study that connects creativity and arrogance. And the British rock group Wild Beasts play live in the studio. But to begin, Fred Astaire. We know him and love him for his choreographed numbers on the silver screen, but he also had a passion for the music that accompanied his steps. In the background, you're hearing a tune that he wrote himself called Just Like Taking Candy from a Baby, and he recorded it with two jazz musicians he greatly admired, clarinetist Benny Goodman and vibes player Lionel Hampton, back in 1940. Joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri, is Todd Decker, who recently wrote a book called Music Makes Me, Fred Astaire and Jazz. Todd, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, the public has long viewed Fred Astaire pretty favorably as a dancer, an actor, occasionally a singer as well, not so much as a musician. How important was music to Fred Astaire?
It was tremendously important to him for audiences to recognize that he was a musician with real playing chops. And this is, you know, in the 30s and 40s, where people like Benny Goodman, a clarinet player, could be a national popular music star and redefine popular music. So in his vaudeville performances and on Broadway, Astaire would make the point that he could, say, play piano or drums. But then in his films, he consistently tried to present himself to the audience as an authentic musician, someone who not only played piano on the screen but was actually, you know, playing the music on the soundtrack as well. So music was tremendously important. When he was asked what he wanted to be or be understood, what he wanted to do that he hadn't done, he would always say, "I want to be a songwriter." So music was tremendously important to him.
The cover of your book, Music Makes Me, is a picture of Fred Astaire playing a drum kit. What was his first instrument? What was his main instrument?
You know, he grew up on vaudeville, performing in vaudeville. And I don't think he would say he had a main. I don't know that he started with drums or with piano as much as he saw people around him playing those instruments and learned how by copying them. He's mainly basically a self-taught musician and dancer, but self-taught in the way of a vaudeville performer who watches others and copies them.
Mm-hmm.
And on the picture on the cover of the book is from the 50s, and it pictures something that he did a lot to practice, which is play drums along with jazz records on his, you know, console stereo that's pictured there. So, you know, he practiced a lot alone like that, and then tried to bring it into his film performances as much as possible.
Now, in terms of his film performances, he was somewhat exceptional, wasn't he? And, I mean, he really had control over what went on in the dance scenes that he was part of.
Yeah, complete control, to the extent where he would make the dance in a closed rehearsal studio with just his rehearsal pianist and sometimes a drummer and you know, an assistant, a choreographer assistant. But he would make the dance and then show it to the director and the producer of the film. And they were expected to recognize that what Astaire had come up with is what would be in the film, down to camera angles. His dance assistant, Hermes Pan, who often helped him, often literally would move the camera during the filming, which, you know, breaks a lot of union rules. Only certain people are supposed to touch the camera. And so he had, you know, tremendous control, not in every number. And there are certain numbers in certain films where he didn't have as much control. But the vast majority of the time, certainly in the 30s when he's working with Ginger Rogers, he is in charge of those numbers.
Well, let's hear something from the soundtrack from a dance that Fred Astaire made and performed with Eleanor Powell in the film Broadway Melody of 1940. This is called Jukebox Dance, and the music they're dancing to was composed there in the rehearsal studio, as it often was in Fred Astaire's movies. And first, we'll hear the soundtrack that they filmed to, and then you'll hear the completed soundtrack with the tap dancing added in. So when you first hear this jukebox dance music from the film Broadway Melody of 1940, the rehearsal footage, so to speak, without the taps, you have this kind of blank space. That, Todd, is the musicians laying out, knowing that Fred is going to fill that space with rhythms of his own.
Right. And they had to do it after the fact because of the way these numbers were made. And where you rehearse the number, record the music, and then when you're shooting the image, they lip-synced and danced to the playback recording. And then in the final stage, after the film that was shot had been edited together, Eleanor Powell and Fred Astaire would have to go back into the recording studio and lay the taps on at that point. Hmm. So it was a really laborious process that could stretch out over months if there was a lag between when the film was shot and when it was recorded in the studio. And the motivation for releasing the soundtrack recording, say on a CD today, is that it has a better sound quality. But if you do that, you leave out this fundamentally musical contribution that Astaire and Powell make. The music is not complete without their tap line as that big hole, that big, you know, break, the big hole in the music in the recording suggests there.
It also
sort of captures one of the paradoxes of considering Astaire as a jazz musician, because mm-hmm. jazz musicians are supposed to improvise in the moment. And given the technological way that Hollywood movies were made, you just didn't improvise in that way. You had to plan ahead.
Although earlier on in his career, you know, when they were not doing the kind of syncing, the after-the-fact syncing, he would have been dancing pretty much live in front of the cameras, right?
Yeah, there's a few musical numbers like that, and one is Music Makes Me Do the Things I Never Should Do from his first film at RKO, The Gay Divorcee, where he's on screen dancing, and there's a group of musicians behind him faking it, and off to the side on the set, there was a group of six Hollywood jazz musicians called to the session to improvise the music for this dance. So there's right at the very beginning of his career, there was still sound and image being recorded together. But very quickly they realized that that just wasn't a practical way mm-hmm. to put a musical film together.
Although it certainly is fun to watch. And Soundcheck listeners, you can watch that moment that Todd Decker was just talking about, the song Music Makes Me, Fred Astaire dancing, on our website. It's on today's show page at wnyc.org/soundcheck. So, Todd, the book is called Music Makes Me, Fred Astaire and Jazz. And, you know, nowadays, jazz does not have the kind of cultural weight that it did back in, say, the 30s and the 40s. It was the popular music of the day. Was everybody dancing the way Fred Astaire was to the local jazz bands?
I wouldn't say they were doing exactly what he did. He had a very unique style, but certainly what he was doing made sense to people. Everybody was out there. Everybody engaged in popular culture was out on the dance floor dancing to this new swing music that saved the popular music industry in the mid-30s. And so I think if you were watching a Fred Astaire movie in the 30s or 40s and you saw him dancing like that, you could, at the very least, you knew what it meant like to move your body to those rhythms and to experience that music in that way. Now, he was an incredible perfectionist and you know, would film the scene shot over and over and over again until he got it just right. So he's this, you know, sort of platonic ideal of what it would be like to dance to swing music. But every, I think, you know, American audiences would have had the rhythms in their bodies and recognized what he was doing as in continuity with what they did.
And was what he was doing different from what, say, Gene Kelly was doing?
I think it was profoundly different. You know, Gene Kelly's career is much shorter than Astaire's. Mm-hmm. He's really only on the musical screen for about 10 years. Astaire's on the screen for maybe for 25 or so. And you know, Kelly was motivated by telling film stories and by fleshing out characters. And he wasn't particularly interested in tap either, in the rhythm and jazz aspect. Well, you know, Astaire was always trying to make a musical point. And his dances began with music that then gets expressed in rhythm, and you know his dance numbers could be picked up from one film and plunked down in another one. You know, he would have the idea, say, of doing a dance number with a golf club, and he would go to the producer of the film and say, you know, hey, I want to do a golf number in this film, and so they'd put a golf number into the film. That works against the way Gene Kelly, you know, wanted to think about psychology and to think about character motivation. So I really see very little similarity between the two of them.
Todd Decker's book is called Music Makes Me, Fred Astaire and Jazz. He's on the line with us from St. Louis. And from a dance called Bouncing the Blues, this is something Fred Astaire did with Ginger Rogers in the 1949 film Barclays of Broadway. This is he's sort of evolving as jazz evolves into bebop. This is a bebop number created during the rehearsal process. That's Fred Astaire in Barclays of Broadway in a tune called Bouncing the Blues. And here, again, as Todd was telling us earlier, the song just isn't complete without the tap dancing, that kind of rhythmic counterpoint to the rest of the band, very much in Fred Astaire's mind, as it often was when he was dancing. Todd, another thing you write about in the book, and another real musical contribution by Fred Astaire, was his willingness, his desire even, to perform alongside and occasionally be a sideman for black musicians at a time when that sort of thing was really rare in the music world. How rare was that in the film industry?
It was almost completely without precedent for him to do a dance with, say, a group of black men in, like he does in the 1937 film Shall We Dance. And the dance was, this is why it's sort of important to remember that, you know, Astaire's dances are his ideas. He's the one that goes in and says, I want to make this number. And the number, the first one that he did was called, was Slap That Bass. And in the production files at RKO, the number is described in some documents, and consistently whoever was writing these documents would write down colored chorus with a question mark, as if Hollywood couldn't even really imagine what it was like, how you would find a colored chorus, first of all, and how you would integrate a group of African Americans into this dance number being led by a white star. And, you know, Astaire does it once in the 30s, and then he does it once in the 40s in a film called You'll Never Get Rich. And, you know, it might sound like very few and far between these numbers, but the way he inserts these African-American musical figures into his films speaks for his interest in jazz as a colorblind art, as a place where he could interact with African-Americans in a way that there really wasn't an opening for in Hollywood. Then he gets to, in the late 50s and early 60s, he goes on television. And consistently, Astaire danced with major jazz, black jazz performers on television. And his television shows were incredibly successful and were produced by his own production company. So again, he's making this choice. And he dances with trumpeter Jonah Jones, who had a lot of some hit LPs at the time. He brings Count Basie onto the show. He does a dance with Jimmy Smith, the jazz organist, in 1965. And, you know, really, so for me, across his career, he's trying to do what jazz players like Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw did, which was look at the music, look at who was playing it, and say, I want to play with the best. I want to work with the best musicians, and I don't care if they're black or white, and I have the power as this, you know, creative Hollywood star in a staircase to say, no, I want to make this number, and it will happen. So.
Well, even before the show in the late 50s, early 60s, back in 1952, he had sort of hooked up with the civil rights advocate and producer Norman Granz for his Jazz at the Philharmonic project, which was an interracial project. And from the multi-disc set of recordings made in 1952 called The Astaire Story, this is Fred Astaire himself introducing a group of really great jazz luminaries of the day.
You know, this album is a kind of jazz album, too, and jazz means the blues. Oscar, Barney, Alvin, and Ray are going to ad-lib some of those blues now, and I'm going to walk in and throw a little hoofing in there. We like these slow blues so much that we decided to do a couple of them.
From The Astaire Story, a multi-disc set of recordings made in the early 50s at the Jazz at the Philharmonic by Fred Astaire. And you heard him at the beginning mentioning Oscar and Barney and Ray. Well, that's Oscar Peterson and Barney Kessel and Ray Brown and Todd Decker. That's like an A-list cast of musicians from back in 1952. Was Fred Astaire really able, as jazz changed shape with each succeeding wave of musicians, was he able to keep up?
I think he definitely did. He listened, like I said, he was an avid record listener and jazz listener in that respect. I don't know that he went out to clubs necessarily, but you know, he got his jazz on records. And he was a popular entertainer, and he knew that if he left his if he wasn't on the cutting edge of whatever popular music was going on, that he would lose his audience. I think this Jazz at the Philharmonic project that Granz, you know, sort of pulled him into, really met this need for him in the early 50s when jazz was changing a lot, to find a place where what he knew as a swing musician was still valued or was still part of the scene. And Jazz at the Philharmonic was exactly that, this interracial project that intended to expand the audience for jazz. And one of the things I think Astaire's career can show us about jazz history is that after bebop came in, swing players continued on until they died, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Astaire kept dancing to swing-style music into the late 60s in an effort, you know, and there was still an audience for it. It was still on television and in recordings like this. You know, he found that place that was left for people that knew how to do what he did.
And how did he view what he did? Did he view himself ultimately as a musician, maybe a musician whose instrument just happened to be tap shoes?
I think he did. I think being a musician, I mean, he thought of himself as an actor, too. I mean, after he stopped making musicals, he had a long career as a dramatic actor. But his identity as a performer, which, you know, has a lot of different aspects to it, was fundamentally tied to music. There's just story after story of, you know, him hearing music and just immediately starting to move. Mm-hmm. And, you know, responding to music in that way. Whether he's writing the song, you know, like I said, he really wanted to be a hit songwriter, or playing piano or drums, or then also dancing. And you know, doing it in the broadest of possible contexts, doing it for the biggest possible audience he could get, was the goal. He didn't have sort of artistic pretensions about it. He wanted to, you know, entertain people.
Mm-hmm. Todd Decker's book is called Music Makes Me, Fred Astaire and Jazz. You can watch, again, a clip of Fred Astaire early in his career dancing to the song Music Makes Me on our webpage today, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Todd, it's a side of Fred Astaire that I don't think we knew much about. Thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Todd mentioned Fred Astaire's lack of pretension. A new study suggests that lack of pretension might be a rarity among so-called creative types. We'll look at the connection between creativity and arrogance next. And then later, a live performance in our studio from the British rock group Wild Beasts.
Take off your shoes.